Yeah, let's rock.
Okay.
We'll call the meeting to order. Our next public hearing is change of zone 1610 Burton's Pond Communities LLC and subdivision 2006-32 Burton's Pond Communities LLC.
This is an application, change of zone 1610 is to amend the comprehensive zoning map from an AR1 agriculture residential district to a MRRPC medium density residential district, residential planned community for a certain parcel of land lying and being in Indian River 100, Sussex County, for land lying east of Route 24 and on both sides of Route 49 being Pine Water Road to be located on 41.94 acres more or less. The application number of subdivision 2006-32 is an application of Burton Pond Communities LLC to consider the subdivision of land in an AR1 agriculture residential district in Indian River 100, Sussex County, dividing 158.7 acres into 265 lots, utilizing the environmentally sensitive developing district overlay zone and located north and south of Road 48 and west of Route 24. For the benefit of the record, the Planning and Zoning Commission was provided with a copy of a small exhibit booklet. That exhibit booklet included 32 figures, references to AR cluster, partially within the environmentally sensitive developing district overlay zone, and also an MRRPC. Included concepts and information related to those 32 figures that are included. It also included I'm going to call this an executive summary, which was included. It also included revised site plans, which are all part of the record. We also have a copy of a rare and threatened and endangered species habitat review prepared by JCM Environmental for the project that is also part of the record. On Monday, we received a correction, an amended section, and it references the subdivision considerations and also has two pages of sediment and erosion control schematic, and also a stormwater best management practices reference. The commission will all have copies of that. That is also part of the record. For the benefit of the commission, I'll pass down copies of the exhibit boards that are going to be presented this evening in the presentation. And we also received letters of opposition, all being provided to the commissioners. I'll pass those down, please. Thank you. From Richard and Susan Berry, Herbert C. Miller, Jr., Russell C. Scott, Mary Ann Scott, David and Meyer Rankin, Robert and Sherilyn McLaughlin, Helen Abrams, Jesse and David Archley, I can't read the handwriting, sorry. Mark Ayers and Sharon Sampson, Randy C. Curry, Samuel and Linda J. Sloan, Carol Wells, John and Elizabeth Bodiger, Joseph and Patricia Quill, Lois Bayless, Mark and Joanne Woodruff, Robin May, the Reverend James D. Von Dreil, I probably said that wrong too, and Kenneth Sales. And they are all a part of the record. The commissioners all have copies. And rather than try to read it all into the record, the majority of them are similar, almost a form type letter. They were individually signed. Probably 30% of them had additional comments added to the correspondence, but they are all provided to the commission. They are all part of the record. And that's all I have at this time, Mr. Chairman. Oh, I did one other thing. The Technical Advisory Committee did review this application on October 25th of 2006, and their comments are included in the file for the subdivision application. That's all I have.
All right, sir. Thank you. Is there anyone here representing this application?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, my name is James Fuquay. I'm an attorney here in Georgetown, a member of the Delaware Bar, and I represent the applicant, Burton Pond Communities, LLC. I know that there are many people here tonight who have interest or perhaps concerns about this proposal, and we're glad to have the opportunity to present our application and to explain the work and the studies that have gone into the design that we're proposing. And we hope we're able to answer a lot of questions that people may have. I wish I could be as quick as I was on the prior application that I had, but I don't think that is going to be the case. We do have a lot of material we want to cover. We have done our best to put together a presentation that will be comprehensive in covering what we think needs to be covered for the record and to explain what we're doing. Because, as you know, we have two separate applications, but the background and the planning and the general information that we have basically applies to both applications. So this will serve as our combined presentation on both those applications and our combined record on both those applications. With me this evening, who will be presenting our presentation, will be a number of people. I'm going to be doing an introduction and covering some of the legal and zoning matters. Mike Lynn, seated right here, is the president of RDM, Inc. He's a member of the Burton Pond Communities, LLC. He'll be addressing the process and the vision of how this development came to be. Scott Agia from McCrone Engineering, the land planners and engineers for the development, he'll be reviewing the site plan and the environmental design. Derek Kennedy of Worth Rogers, they are the traffic engineers, and he's going to be reviewing the traffic impact study that was done and reviewed by DelDOT and the proposed road improvements. Jerry Esposito from Tidewater Utilities and Tidewater Environmental Services will be addressing the water and sewer service for the development. And Todd Frith of EnviroTech basically did the analysis and prepared an environmental management service plan for Burton Pond, and he'll be explaining that document. We have some other members here from the consulting team that went into this development, and they'll be available for questions that may come up, but it's not my plan to call them. Now, as Mr. Lang stated, in connection with our application, there was a number of things submitted. One was an exhibit book, which was a summary book of the applications. Contains a lot of information data. Also, there was the rare and endangered species report that was done, and then the large exhibit book, which is really an appendix containing a number of the studies and reports that were performed in connection with the application. And in that book, there is reference to information about the soil reconnaissance report that was done, the wetland investigation that was done, as I mentioned, the Burton Pond environmental assessment that was done, the traffic impact study, a cultural and archaeological study that was done, an economic impact report that was prepared, conclusions of the summaries of the Phase 1 and limited Phase 2 environmental site assessments that were prepared, as I mentioned, the rare and endangered species. And in the very last section of that large book, there are resumes of all the professional qualifications of the people who will be speaking tonight. Okay. Now, the location of the Burton Pond Communities, as the name indicates, is on both the east and west sides of Route 24, just south of Burton Pond. The parcel on the east, which would be this parcel here, so on the right, if you were heading toward Route 1, that parcel contains 42 acres, It's currently zoned AR1. It is located entirely in the environmentally sensitive development area, as designated under the current Sussex County Land Use Plan. The environmentally sensitive development area under the plan is a growth area. It's defined by the plan as a developing district with special environmental design and protection requirements. The plan specifically recognizes under its guidelines for housing types that single-family detached homes, as well as townhouses and condominiums, are appropriate in that growth zone. On the east parcel, we are proposing an MRRPC containing 102 multifamily units located in 15 separate buildings. The buildings will have a style of what's referred to as the big house or an estate house, having the architectural appearance of a large single-family type home. On this site, an MRRPC, per the RPC calculations, would permit a maximum of 174 units. We are proposing and are requesting 102 units, which would be a density on this particular parcel of 2.43 units per acre. The total open space on this parcel would be 31.8 acres, or approximately 75% of the site. The parcel on the west side of Route 24 contains 158.7 acres. It is currently zoned AR1 and will remain AR1. The western parcel is in the low density area under the comprehensive plan, except for a portion which is adjacent to Route 24 and running back 600 feet from Route 24, which under the land use plan is considered to be in the environmentally sensitive developing area. The land use plan provides that in the low density area, low-density single-family residential housing is appropriate, but housing types in that low-density area are limited to single-family detached homes on individual lots. Now, as you know, single-family homes on individual lots are both a stated purpose of the AR zone and a permitted use in the AR zone, as provided in the comprehensive land use plan. In addition, the environmentally sensitive development area overlay ordinance and the AR cluster ordinance both authorize the clustering of lots, which basically permits lot sizes to be reduced to 7,500 square feet, and that results in the ability to create areas of community open space for recreational purposes, aesthetic purposes, and environmental conservation purposes. The west parcel is proposed to have 265 single-family lots on 158.7 acres. That would be a density of 1.67 lots per acre, which is significantly less than the two lot per acre, which is permitted in that district. The actual average lot sizes on the western parcel would be about 9,500 square feet per lot. The total open space on the western parcel is 80.8 acres, or approximately 51% of that parcel. Recreational facilities will be located on both the east and the western sites. The total gross density of the combined development would be 367 residential units on 200.7 acres, which is about 1.82 residential units per acre. And Scott Agia will be discussing in detail the site plan in a few moments. Now, the reason we have two applications is basically my responsibility and my recommendation. In a less complex world, I think the Burton Pond community proposal, based on its concept and its design, would have been filed as one RPC application. However, because a portion of the land is located in the growth area and a portion of the land is located in the low-density area, it was my opinion that the RPC designation in the low-density area may not be deemed appropriate. And that was based on my opinion from my experience, and I'll specifically mention the Isaacs Glen application, which was originally filed as an RPC application and was denied by the county for basically those types of reasons. So accordingly, We have two applications. One is for a cluster subdivision on the western parcel and for an MRRPC on the eastern parcel, which is located in the growth zone. Now, as to the compliance with the land use plan, I think from reading the letters, and I have read all the letters that were submitted for the record, and I think probably the main point that's raised in those letters were concerns about the MRRPC request in the environmentally sensitive development area and whether or not that was in conformance with the plan. Bear with me a second. The a point raised in the letters is to the effect that provisions of the current comprehensive plan would prohibit this change of zone in the environmentally sensitive development area. And I would disagree with that. The letters, which I think as Mr. Lang stated, there seems to be a form letter that at least was the basis for a lot of the letters that were submitted. And it quotes some language in there from the plan that says it is the intent of the land use plan to retain the existing zoning districts as shown on the official zoning map for Sussex County as of the adoption of the comprehensive plan. And I think that's something you have to take time to read. And if you read it in the context of the plan, what it's actually saying is when this plan was adopted and that map was created, they weren't changing any of the existing zoning districts. In other words, they were incorporating the existing zoning districts as a given. And there was no recommendation or change in the plan. So in other words, they were adopting the intent was to use the existing zoning districts as of the time of the adoption of the plan as shown. And if you actually go into the plan itself, the environmentally sensitive development area, and this is on page 14 of the plan, as I've already stated, it specifically says that it's a growth district. It states in the plan that the environmentally sensitive developing area can be defined as a developing district with special environmental design and protection requirements. And as we'll be showing, we have done special environmental design and protection provisions. The land use plan goes on to say, under the section guidelines for infrastructure, that extension of central wastewater systems to this area to serve failing on-site systems and new developments will protect the inland bays from excessive amounts of nutrients. And again, as we'll be explaining in our presentation, we will have Tidewater providing the wastewater service for this site. The land use plan goes on to say that several privately owned companies provide water service in this area. Expansion of these services plus a potential county water system is desirable. And again, we're going to have Tidewater providing a public water company providing public water to this site. Again, under the land use plan, under guidelines for housing types under the environmentally sensitive area, it states housing types approved in the environmentally sensitive district include single-family detached homes, townhouses, condominiums. It goes on to say that residential planned communities and village-style development should be encouraged in this area to provide open space and to protect habitat. And again, I think as you'll go through the plan, you'll see that that's exactly how the Burton communities were designed. Under guidelines for density in the environmental sensitive area, the plan states the county should enact an ordinance requiring any applicant of a major development to provide information and analysis addressing the development's environmental impact. Again, we will be addressing that. And the report that's now required by the Environmental Overlay District is part of our exhibit, and I'll be referring to that later. And lastly, and I think this really answers the question about whether you can change a zone in the environmentally sensitive development area, the plan states any increased density by rezoning should only be permitted with proper environmental safeguards. So the plan clearly recognizes that you can increase density by rezoning, but it cautions that it should only be permitted with proper environmental safeguards. Now that obviously is a standard that we have to meet, and it's a standard that you have to find that we do meet, and I'm confident that after our presentation, you'll agree that we have met that burden. For the record, I just want to touch a couple of things. The Burton Pond communities, as I've mentioned, will have a central water system. It'll be served by Tidewater Utilities for domestic use and fire protection. Tidewater Environmental Services will own and operate the community wastewater treatment and disposal system. And again, Jerry Esposito is here, and he'll be discussing that. As to fire protection, the site is actually partially in the Lewis-Rehoboth service area. And I think you're familiar with Lewis-Rehoboth has a joint substation on Route 24 just slightly north of this site. And it's also partially in the Indian River Fire Company coverage area. The site is in the Cape Henlopen School District. Retail and service businesses are located nearby in the Long Neck area. It's the intent of the development to have one homeowners association that will be responsible for the enforcement of the covenants, the collection of fees. The homeowners association will operate and maintain the recreational facilities and the common areas. And that will include, as we'll be explaining, the environmental management plan for Burton Pond. During the planning stages of the Burton Pond community's design, as required, we submitted an application to PLUS, and we met for a PLUS review. This was actually back in August of 2005. From that review, we received numerous comments and suggestions from the agency representatives, and the site plan was modified to incorporate several changes that did improve and benefited the original design. Initially, if you look at the original September 15, 2005 PLUS letter, the Office of State Planning Coordination stated that they could not support the western subdivision portion of this application because it was in a level four area under the state strategies plan. However, the state planning office stated that they had no objection to the proposed east parcel development. Now, that is the multifamily MRRPC application that's in the growth area. We discussed with the state planning office that, in our opinion, the level four designation on a portion of this parcel was really a misnomer, and that if you realistically considered the existing nature of the area, you would find that this is not the traditional level four area, because the Burton Pond parcels are really surrounded by residential development. And I'd like to just refer to the site map. And basically, here's Route 24. That's running toward Route 1. It's running toward Millsboro. Our parcel, the Burton Pond communities, this piece right here, the western piece, and then the eastern piece right there in the darker green. To the east of the site, located right here, is a residential development called Brandywood. And then also in this area here are Herring Creek Estates and Pinewater Farms. Adjacent to our site, to the north along the pond, are two smaller subdivisions, Angolaville and Holly Patch, which are right in here. If you go further north on 24, I think everyone's familiar with Angola by the Bay and continuing developments down that road. Located basically on the other side of Burton Pond is the development Lockwood. That's on the north side of the pond. Lockwood is zoned MR. It is zoned medium density residential. West of the site, adjacent to the site, is the Greenbank Estates development and River Oaks. Located southwest of our property and bordering our property is the Hollyway Campground. That's a campground that's been there for some time, and it has actually over 1,000 40 by 50 foot campsites that are located on that site. If you go south, down Route 24, you come to the Baywood Green site, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with, the residential development, as well as the golf course. The Baywood Green site does contain multifamily sections as integrated into that whole development. Just past that is the Pines at Long Neck, and then, of course, as you go down Route 5, there's the many sections of Stonewater Creek and numerous other developments that have been approved and are under construction in that area. So really, in light of what really is existing here, the Burton Pond site is really what would be called in zoning terms an infill parcel. It's an undeveloped parcel in the middle of an established pattern of residential development. And we believe what's being proposed is really consistent with and in accordance with the existing nature of the area. Now, as I mentioned, in response to numerous discussions with the state agencies and modifications that were done to the site plan, Mrs. Holland, the director of the Office of State Planning Coordination, sent a follow-up letter to Lawrence Lank, dated December 7, 2005. And those comments are important and somewhat, at least in the applications I present, somewhat exceptional. And I would like to refer to them. This letter is already in your record. I have highlighted the sections I'll be referring to, and I'll just hand that out to Mr. Blank if you pass that down. So in and I'll just be referring to the portions that I highlighted on there. So again, in this letter, which is the response letter to the comments that Scott Aegis submitted to PLUS, Mrs. Holland states, after reviewing the developer's response, we have the following additional comments. As seen through the material submitted by the developer, efforts were made to create a project design that respects the natural environment and truly achieves the intent of the cluster ordinance. DENREC comments acknowledge the environmentally sensitive design in the PLUS letter, but also express concern regarding the loss of some forest on site. In response to that comment, the developer, this isn't typed properly here, so I'll say what I think it's supposed to say, the developer removed and nearly reduced impact to forested lands from 3.3 acres to 0.25 acres. In response to the state's concern that the proposal is located partially within an investment level 4 area, the developer notes that while this is the case, it is truly an infill development with existing or approved development almost entirely surrounding it. While state policies do not support development in investment 4 areas, we note the developer's point that it straddles the transition between investment levels 3 and 4 and that it is an infill site. For these reasons, the state does not oppose the proposal. The letter goes on to state on the second page, referring to some comments from state agencies, the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs commended the developer for avoiding and protecting the areas identified by HCI as possible archaeological sites. HCI was Height Consulting, which was our archaeological consultant. Also, the letter states that the Department of Agriculture stated that they appreciate the developer's efforts to positively respond to concerns forwarded by state agencies and are particularly glad to see a reduction in the acres of forest land impacted by the development proposal, as well as the proposed forestation proposals. The department does realize this site straddles level 3 and 4 areas, and as such, their response was influenced by multiple priorities. DDA thanked McCrone for their good faith effort to address theirs and other state agencies' concerns. They noted they have no objection to the project as currently proposed, and also attached to that is another letter that came after the PLUS letter. This is a letter dated October 23rd, 2006, from DenRec's Division of Parks and Recreation. It's actually addressed to Shane Abbott. It says, the Office of Nature Preserves appreciates the opportunity to comment on the Burton's Pond Community's development plan. The forested riparian lands located on the southern portion of the site is considered to be within a state-designated natural area as well as a state resource area. I appreciate the applicant's efforts to remain out of these environmentally important areas. So in summary, I think our dealings with the PLUS process and the ultimate response from the state shows that the state has no objection to either the MRRPC East application or to the subdivision application on the west. Now, both the RPC ordinance and the AR cluster ordinance have a common purpose. If you read them, they basically have a similar purpose. Both of them are designed to be tools to create, in the language of the RPC ordinance, a, quote, superior living environment, close quote, while the cluster ordinance seeks, quote, a total environment and design which is superior to a standard subdivision. Both ordinances encourage design ingenuity to create usable open space and conservation areas, and those concepts were the basis for the design of the Burton Pond communities. It was recognized from the very beginning of the planning for this proposal that it was the applicant's responsibility, and I would add it was the applicant's intention and goal to consider both the history of this land, the environmental aspects of the land, and the development impacts on the land in formulating this plan of design. And I will tell you that we were aware that the Angola area was a small hamlet that existed back at the time of the American Revolution. The actual main portion of that site was located just north of our property. During the 19th century, there were mills that developed in the area, along with stores and homes. Height consultants, as I mentioned, were retained to study the land. And basically, the intention was to develop a design that would preserve the historic areas and not damage them. In other words, we wanted to plan around any potential historic impact. And just as important, if not more important, environmental studies were done to identify and consider the best design to preserve and enhance the natural features and the beauty of the property, the wetlands, the woodlands, and of course, and most importantly, Burton Pond itself. We're going to be presenting our design and environmental management service plan for Burton Pond. And I think when you see the detail that goes into that, it certainly is a step that's going to help preserve and protect that pond forever. And then lastly, of course, we needed to address the development impact, the water and the wastewater, the traffic impact, the social impact of the development on the area. With that as a beginning, what I'd like to do at this point is to turn our presentation over to Mike Lynn. And then after Mike, I'm going to introduce a series of speakers to address the other items that I've mentioned.
Good evening. For the record, my name is Michael Lynn. I'm president of RDM, and we're a builder-developer located in Ocean View. As Jim said, we're a member of the Burton Pond Communities LLC, and our partner members are Ocean Atlantic and David G. Horsey and Bobby Horsey. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present this project for your review and consideration. As Jim has detailed, he's gone over the specifics of our request as well as touching on the technical work that has gone into our proposal. And you're going to hear from our engineers, our traffic consultants, utility provider, as well as our environmental consultant. And they'll go forward to detail the research, investigation, and final determinations that went into the design. What I'd like to do is share with you our thoughts as a developer and our land planning approach that we took on the property. As you heard from Jim, you're reviewing a development of 367 homes planned on 200 acres. And the community contains a series of both passive and active amenities tied together with both a road and open space network. What we had under contract and have under contract as purchasers from the Burton family was 260 acres. And the reduction in the land that is planned for development is sort of my opportunity to explain our thoughts and design approaches. I thought it, in fairness to you and to us, rather showing you a finished product, I'd like to take you from the beginning. As I said, the entire Burton track contains 260 acres. If you don't mind, I'd like to just run my finger over that plan. The southern edge, our western edge.
Excuse me a second, Mr. Lynn. Would you mind doing the same thing he's doing so these people can see you?
And you have to flip up. You jumped ahead of in my presentation.
Yeah, if you would follow, you know, flip that back to so you guys get on the same page.
Can you move this up closer? Because I feel way away from what I want to be. If you don't mind, if I can move this
now,
up.
Now, please do,
bit.
Because the mics need to pick you up anyway. But this way, the folks. If there's anyone in the back would like to move up into this section so you can see better, please feel free to do so now.
Can you see it up here?
Okay. Well, it's a little difficult. This will be faced towards the public at all times so you can see that, but you might, those of you in the way back corner might be able to see it better if you move up into here. This isn't like church. No lightning's going to strike. A preacher's not going to call on you or anything, so... Okay, sir.
Thank you. Under the contract was also the what they call the Burton Pond, and across the street are the 42 acres that Jim just referenced, as well as an additional 17-acre tract that does not show dotted along here, but which was studied. Along the southern border of the property is a substantial forested and non-tidal wetland area. Along the north, we have as a boundary Burton Pond and again some non-tidal wetlands and wooded area. Across on our eastern portion, we have a substantial growth, about 6 to 12 acres of standing forest on the southern end, and again, our northern border here is the upland forest and wooded wetland and wetland area. In between both of these areas that I've described are farm and pasture and farm. Our initial research and understanding the property began with a series of field investigations and studies done by a number of engineering disciplines. Cumulatively, this work, coupled with our fundamental development goals we set from the start, helped determine our final land plan. Good community design begins with, I believe this strongly, with an understanding of the property and a recognition in the land plan of site constraints, site features, and site opportunities. In the case of the Burton Pond, the opportunities were its strongest assets, and they were the Burton Pond, old growth, this area of growth, forested, and this area. They were its environmental anchors, the pond and the forested areas at each end of the property. Our approach was to identify, map, and work to avoid site constraints, identify, map, and work to either preserve or enhance special site features, and finally, to identify, map, and work to protect and manage the site assets. This really isn't a novel approach to land development and land planning, but it is the responsible approach. In the case of Burton's Pond, it was the only approach. Given the pond, the woods, and the environmental makeup of both this property and the immediate surrounding areas, what we would avoid, what we would protect, what would be preserved, and the areas that we would enhance would eventually establish the areas where we were going to develop. Working from the edges in, we began our investigation with identifying the wetlands on the site. And this overlay indicates the wetlands, non-tidal wetlands, that were identified. We hired JCM, environmental consultants, to identify the extent of the wetlands on the property. And that's the blue line. Once JCM flagged their field determination, our surveyor located these boundaries and transferred this information to what we use is called a development base sheet. And one of our design goals from the beginning was to not only avoid intrusion into the wetlands, but also establish setbacks between the wetland boundaries and what we were going to develop. Next, we then located our upland wood line. In this case, we utilized our surveyor to locate the woods, and that's this heavy green line. This darker line is the aerial shadow of the flight at the time of day it was taken, but the wood line is this area. That's approximately 16 acres, and this area, which is approximately 12 acres, and this serves as a substantial buffer between both these subdivisions that exist to our south. Another goal coupled with this exploration was to minimize the clearing and the introduction of any development into existing upland woods on the site. Then from our research of the area, and specifically from an adjoining property owner who shared an afternoon of history with us, we learned that this area in general and specific areas on this site had some archaeological significance. We engaged Height Consulting to do a preliminary investigation of the entire 260 acres. From this investigation, Height determined that there were 12 areas of interest within the Burton Pond. And they are outlined in this, whatever color that is, purple color here. And what's buried by the green is this flowing area that is partially in our woods and partially within the non-tidal wetlands. Based on their assessment of the archaeological significance of some of these sites, they proceeded to do a phase one study. And this enabled them to basically go out and do test pits and begin to put some definitions on particular sites. And those sites were here, here, some areas along in here, and some exploration, light exploration up in this area. Again, the surveyor, based on Height's field work, located these sites, and then they were added to the development base sheet, which is basically what's this is becoming. And based on Height's information, we established at that time the goal of avoidance where possible, preservation wherever possible, and at the least, minimize the impact of the development on these areas. And while we're here, just a by right subdivision joining us on the western parcel, that woods connected here. And in their development scheme, they ended up placing their stormwater management in that wooded area. Now, I'm not sure, I believe there is no wetlands impact, but if I could take the green, this purple line continues through that site and joins up across here. We were not going to impact through our development or minimize impact through our development what we recognized and what we were told were our archaeological sites of interest. And part of our due diligence, continued due diligence, we contacted DelDOT to review the development impacts on the existing road system. After establishing the designated intersections to study, we began the traffic counts and the foundation of the TIS report. But early on in our discussions with DelDOT, both parties recognized that a fix of Route 24 could not be solely generated as a result of traffic that would come from this proposed development. However, because of the recognized safety issues that DelDOT knew and we learned as we explored this site, a major realignment of Sloan Road on the east with Holly Mount Road on the west could be achieved as a result of the development on this site. By abandoning these existing configurations, Sloan and Holly Mount could come into a 90-degree intersection that would be controlled with a traffic light. Immediate improvements could be made to a dangerous road condition existing prior to this development on Route 24. Also, at the same time, on the development base map, we added the 60-foot strip of land. Do you mind pointing that out? Along Route 24 to be preserved as a DelDOT right-of-way for future widening. As Jim has said, water will be provided by Tidewater Utilities from a main located in the Angola Road area. No on-site wells would be permitted, nor any elevated tanks would be allowed in our site. Sewer would be handled by on-site wastewater treatment facilities, which will be owned and operated by Tidewater Utilities. To determine the suitability of the soils and really the feasibility of whether a community system could actually operate on the property, Eastern Shore Soil Services was hired to provide the necessary analysis. From the general determination of soil suitability, he then located the best soil areas for this type of treatment application, which is the RIB system. Those two sites were located, both are approximately 2.5 acres, and subsequently mapped on the development base sheet, here and here. What I'd like to do is go now to a compilation board. Again, this gives us an opportunity to kind of tell a story of the first plan you saw up, how we eventually ended up putting the homes and planning the project as we did. Compiling all this information on a development base sheet establish the areas or development envelopes where homes, recreation, and open space could be placed. We planned this project in its entirety as one community. But for my discussions, what I'd like to do is focus first on the western parcel. We determined that the use, as Jim has said, of the AR cluster would allow us to achieve not only our original development goals and intentions, but create a means to plan a superior single-family community by utilizing smaller lots and then taking that residual area to create open space. Our approach in designing this open space was to avoid massing areas into one or two locations. It's been our experience that when this is done, taking that approach really benefits the few in the community that sit upon the open space, to sometimes to the exclusion of others. We wanted to put this space in contact with as many single-family owned lots as possible. Taking this approach would allow each resident immediate access, can begin to flip over to the green, to a green area. Again, typically massing the open space creates a benefit for what I call the fortunate few in the community to the exclusion of the balance. Like I said, we wanted each lot to touch this space, and we designed a green stream, a corridor, or a green street that would flow through the community. If we accomplish this, we would not only have the hard system of transportation and communications via the roads and sidewalks to each lot, but we'd offer a soft communication to the rear of each lot, the green open space corridor, which would contain the paths and amenities that would flow through the community, accessible to each owner, and linking the residents of the community. Additionally, we would be creating habitat corridors throughout by pulling from the natural basis of the existing environment on the southern end of the property. These corridors establish a natural connection, again, between the southern part of the property and the northern part of the property. So our plan for the western parcel, reviewing our initial goals, were to avoid the wetlands and establish setbacks from the wetlands. All non-tidal wetlands were avoided, and we established setbacks from the boundary of the southern end of the property on an average of 200 foot to the rear of the lot, not to a structure, but to the rear of the lot, and on the northern end of the property around the pond, an average of 75 feet setback from the non-tidal wetlands to the back of the lot. We cleared no woods along the southern boundary, leaving intact approximately 14 plus acres of upland woods. We minimized clearing on the northern boundary to just under 1/4 of an acre, which occurs right in this area here. We either avoided or minimized the development impacts on the archaeological sites of interest. And finally, we realigned Sloan and Holly Mount Roads and added new 60-foot right-of-way dedications. Can we flip it? With these and the incorporation of the green corridor open space, our site plan developed to include 265 lots on 159 acres at the density that Jim referred to at 1.67 units an acre, with an average lot size of 9,500 square feet. And the design green space and amenity area is approximately 40 acres, coupled with the existing upland forested areas and the non-tidal wetlands left, again, about 80 plus acres open. I wanted to touch base, but this really isn't the proper plan, but it allows me to connect in these green spaces. These plants are deceptive. We're talking about nearly a football field, 180, 200 to 300 feet between these homes. We were able to put green space and corridors behind every home with the exception of this section here. Within those pass systems, within the corridors are our path systems and located three amenities that are park playgrounds, and they are directed towards our major anchor amenity, which is a swimming pool, clubhouse, and tennis that is situated on Burton's Pond. And as I said, Burton's Pond is 43 acres of impounded water, and it was purchased by the LLC. It serves now as our anchor for the proposed community, It's the location of our community amenities. But when we took it, we recognized that we would become the stewards of this feature. Our goal was to establish the means and methods to one, and I thought this was important because I used to commute between Potnets and where I was employed early in my other life, and I would come by and there would be fishing on that constantly, and I would see the pickup trucks and the people going through and utilizing this area to access and fish off that pond. We wanted to continue its use as a community at large, outside our community, at large recreation and fishing area. We wanted to ensure the continued viability of its ecosystem, and we wanted to improve current conditions in the pond. And finally, we wanted to minimize the impact our proposal would have on the pond itself. And to accomplish that, very early on, we hired EnviroTech to initiate an analysis of the system pond. I call it a system because I've been listening to Todd, but it's the pond. And based upon this analysis and our objectives, establish a management program for Burton's Pond to achieve what we wanted. The pond is not calculated into our AR cluster application, but will be managed by Burton Pond LLC through the development and construction phase until the point when the homeowners association and that community is both active and educated to its responsibilities regarding the pond. And you'll hear from Todd in depth about that. As you'll see when our engineer, Scott Asia, comes, what we have planned here is a park and a parking lot with an entrance here close to 24. So that will be the point where the community at large can access, park and access this pond, and also access this park, approximately 2-acre park. That park system is a self-surface park because in recognition of the archaeological sites, points of interest in that area, and under Heights Advisement Consultant, we established that as a non-intrusive, minimal impact park on that area. Now, what I like to do is flip over to the east side and focusing on the eastern portion. Our initial development goals and intentions remain the same since we had planned this Burton's property as one community, though separated by a series of roads. We wanted no wetland impact. We wanted to minimize tree removal and avoid impacts or minimize impacts on the archaeological sites of interest. But additionally, there were two goals and some reaffirmation of an original. First, we felt and we wanted to provide an alternative housing type besides the single family lot home offering that would address a segment of the market that does not want a lot of home and wants little or no outside maintenance responsibility. Reviewing the success of the multifamily units located at Baywood, about a mile or less than a mile from this site. South of this, it was apparent to us that a well-planned, architecturally attractive alternative to a single-family lot home, which was already included on our western section, would meet a need. Let me see. More importantly, by this type of land use, we could provide for a much needed housing absent from the county's current housing stock, a home that is affordable to Sussex residents in an area that has become somewhat out of reach for a portion or segment of the local population. And we wanted an opportunity to provide affordable housing by committing 20 of the 102 units to the county's MPHU program. And finally, in a reaffirmation of an original goal, we wanted to keep this wood line as it is. We wanted to keep, and I'm jumping a little bit ahead, but by applying the design flexibility of the MRRPC application, the ability to cluster and mass the units in a cohesive land plan allowed for the significant natural feature, which is that 12 acres of woods, to remain intact. The layout allowed the creation of significant setbacks from Route 24. I believe that's 250 feet to the center line of the road, 200 feet, 150 foot to the edge of Sloan, and probably 180 feet from this portion. Setting those units back off of both road systems, where landscape buffers would be planted to enhance the existing natural growth and provide a visual screen. This plan also provides the opportunity to avoid impact on the archaeological sites of interest as well. I'm going to point out this site here is an 18th century, you wouldn't know it, but he found it from his research and field investigation. That's an 18th century structure. That's the existing grave site. This is the old Angola Road that used to connect and bring supplies to the mill that was located here. One area that was found to be of significance was this area in here. That was the 17 acres. That was what they termed prehistoric. And it was of such a nature, there's a dump site located here, and the dump site is the mother lode for archaeologists. They are able to determine patterns of life, style, eating habits, and living habits. We removed that from our development scheme and application, that's 17 acres, and it is not to be developed and will remain as it exists on that plan. Of the 42 acres which were included in the MRRPC application, we propose 102 multifamily units on the site. Can we? And what we're proposing as a housing is a unit called the Big House. And the Big House is a trademark, so we have to use that term, but it came as a result of the feeling that it looked like a big house. And that project will contain, if approved, will contain 6 and 8 unit buildings. And what we would do would be, if application is accepted in the MPHU unit program, we would disperse the 20 units, the program units, throughout these buildings. The next, because you see a plan and it's about the size of your fingernail, what I wanted to do is bring another exhibit to give you some idea of what the big house is in comparison. You can just stick it up. I'm sorry. The house below it is a unit that is in Redwood. It's about a 3,200 square foot, 4-bedroom, 3.5 bath. And within the architect's ability to scale them together, and they worked off this door as being 3 foot and 3 foot, that is, in comparison, what these units will be. And I guess that's how the people that developed this prototype came about to term it big home, big house. The big house concept has been successful and is in place at Painter's Mill, and it's been well received by the public and seems to integrate itself well into that community. Our open space and amenities on this property, including the upland forested areas, is over 30 acres, which is about 70% of the site remains open. And we intend to complement the overall community amenities located on Burton's Pond with an additional swimming pool and tennis court and bathhouse centrally located for the use and enjoyment of this community. Both communities' amenities are not mutually exclusive, but certainly given the constraints that exist on the road, providing an amenity located to those units, if you approve the concept, would be the best way to handle the needs, recreational needs, of that aspect of the community. We intend this property to be one community, and it was planned as such. And I've had an opportunity to discuss our overall development goals and intentions for this project, applying them both to the eastern and western parcels to help explain our intentions and really how we got to where we are, the basis for the land plan we're presenting, and our rationale, besides our attorney's advice, for selecting the zoning categories to accomplish our objectives. And with that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the plan with you.
Roger. Very good.
Jim, we're going to go from the more abstract from myself and Mr. Lynn to some of the more specifics and the site plan. Scott Age is going to address the site plan now.
Okay. Mark, if you put up the overall, I'd appreciate it. Good evening. Hope to move things along a little faster here and pick this thing up. I'm Scott Age. I'm a professional engineer. I'm also vice president of Macron Incorporated from Salisbury. I have 30 years of land planning and engineering experience. And we're located at 119 Naylor Mill Road, Salisbury. I also have with me Brent Jett. He's also a professional engineer from our firm. And Mark Scher has been helping out on the other side. The resumes, it wasn't mentioned, but the resumes of our team are located in the back of that three-ring binder. I think it's important to point that out because we have with us a real set of experts. And for me, this is exciting because I don't get the opportunity, and you probably don't get to see too many plans where you've got a real group of experts who've taken the time, in this case, up to 2 years, we've been working on this thing to get the land plan right. So I want to go through a couple of the things with you here. Jim gave you an overview, and Mike gave you the sense of the superior environmental sensitive development that we're doing here. And it truly is conceived by Mike and then planned as a superior development. As far as other team members will be talking to you, you've heard a little bit about the traffic and water and sewer and the pond, too. So they'll be very specific, and I'll kind of go past those items. I'm going to start with the existing conditions, a couple of them, and then go right into the single-family parcel and then the multi-family parcel. So as far as existing conditions, I'm not going to repeat a lot of what Jim and Mike have already told you because they've given you a lot of details, probably too many already, but they are AR side, or it started as an AR1 site, and of course now we've got the two different parcels to it so we can provide a variety for this. As far as flood zones, nobody's talked about that. We have no tidal waters here they're adjacent to it, and the flood zones are AE and X, which are basically above 100-year or very little impact by 100-year flood. Soils, the soils generally vary quite a lot across the site. However, Jerry Esposito will go into that a little bit with the wastewater and show you where the best soils were, and I think you've seen where it's going to go. Wetlands, Jim McCulley delineated. He actually went out and set flags at this point, so they're not approximate, they're exact. We do not have a JD from the Corps, but I can tell you based on past experience with Jim McCulley, it's going to be real close. He also did the rare, threatened, and endangered species, which you've seen. Boundary topographic surveys were conducted on the site. There's information in the three-ring binder. Again, it shows from the deeds what the acreage was, and then a recent survey that was done by Compass Point Associates shows the actual acreage, which we've used in this application. And then An environmental phase one audit was conducted by Hills Carnes, and they studied looking for surface contamination, any contamination that may have been a result of the previous Angola development. They also went out and took some field borings at a location or two just to verify that there were no underground tanks that were leaking that they could find of anything, and there was nothing discovered. So that ceased. Of course, you've heard about High Consultant looking after the archaeologic sites, and Orth Rogers has gone through a very extensive study, both preliminary and finals, so on the traffic. So there's a lot of expertise that goes into this thing. As far as the going to the first board, I want to go to the AR1 cluster, cluster overlay. I'm not going to repeat all the existing square footages other than the lot sizes were proposed a minimum of 7,500. They do vary up to 15 or just about 15,000 square foot on the radial lots, which is almost a factor of two from the requirements that we've set. Lot depths were set at a minimum of 100 feet and 75 foot wide. Truth of the matter is we're trying for 80 feet because you can fit multiple building products on that better, and most of the lots are that width. Front yard setback 25 feet, side 10 foot both sides, rear 10 foot, and on corner lots, like you previously heard, 15 foot. Maximum building height 42 feet. So we're sticking with all those as proposed. Roadways themselves, 50-foot right-of-ways. So we're certainly meeting all the county requirements there. 12-foot lanes. The collector road, Brent, could you show where the collector road is run down through? This collector road is kind of an internal neighborhood collector road. That one will probably have three lanes at intersections. That road is rather special in that it has no driveways at front on it. It strictly is a collector road, and kind of a greenway multimodal path system also runs along there. And quite frankly, that area ranges, if you went from the rear yard on each side of that, about 150 to 200 foot wide. So that's quite a swath through there, and you won't feel like you're on an urban street by any means. There will be curb and gutter. The sidewalks will be on both sides of these neighborhood streets, except the collector road, which will just have that multimodal path on one side. There will be street lights. Of course, the utilities being water and sewer provided by Tidewater, that Jerry will talk about a little bit. Street lights will be provided. And let's see, Jim's already talked about other utilities of Verizon, Delaware Electric Co-op, MediaCom, et cetera. Buffers. I want to go, well, let me talk a little bit about these sites. First of all, on the cluster side again, we ended up, we're allowable lots, 327. The number again, I want you to think about that, because we only ended up with 265. We really kept it below what could go in there, and that was due to this green concept. Open spaces. We've got a lot of open space. Open space totaled up to 80 acres on that side of the of Route 24. Again, about 51% open space, which exceeds the 30% requirement. And then as far as buffers, next boards, we'll put up the buffers. I'm going to start along the pond side. There are, again, no tidal wetlands, only non-tidal wetlands. And it was our objective to have no lots right up against the wetlands. We've provided buffers to the pond from 42 foot at an absolute minimum, and that was just at one corner of a lot, to 115 feet, which averages 75 feet along the pond. and then along Unity Branch. It varies from the next board. It varies from 73 feet at one point to over 250 feet as far as the from the back of the lot to the wetland buffer, or I mean to the wetlands, and that averages 200 foot of buffer. So we have a tremendous amount of buffers, basically unheard of in a lot of developments. As far as other buffers are concerned, there's more on that same side, 30 feet along both sides of Holly Mount Road. If you want to go back to the original picture, we have 30 feet on each side of Holly Mount Road that are buffers. And then we have 40 feet around the wastewater treatment and clear water disposal basins. There's 40 feet there. Then there's 30 feet along the east side or the Green Bank Estate side. And that's a buffer. And then we have a 30-foot buffer along Route 24 for the remainder of the area from the 40-foot down to the south end of the site. These buffers will be bermed and landscaped along the major roads and around wastewater facilities. As far as plant materials, we're going to use native plant materials there to the area so that eventually when it all grows in, it will look as though it was meant to be. I want to speak a little bit about greenways. Now, this greenway and the multimodal pass system that we're putting, again, we're on the same side of the road again, on the cluster side, provides for safe biking and walkways separate from the streets. If you'll see in the middle, we've got 70 to 100 foot of space that's between the rear yards. Now, that is in one of the tight areas, which I'll show you. That section that's taken across here is basically taken right across here, which is one of the tighter areas of the site as far as the greenways are concerned. So if it was taken at a different section, you'd have even a larger distance between the rear yards than that 70 to 100 foot. As Mike alluded to, there's about 30 acres of that greenway space. It's not only greenways, but it's also groundwater recharge area. And groundwater recharge will not only be there, but it'll be also on the other 50 acres that are open space on that side. As far as the pathway, the interconnecting pathway, the multimodal pathway that goes through the site, that'll be approximately an 8-foot hard surface. For the residents as far as walking and biking, and then there will be a soft surface, approximately 4 foot, soft meaning wood chips, that type of material, that will weave among the trees along the south end of the site and the forested areas. Also on the cluster side, the site amenities. Site amenities, in addition to the multimodal pathways, we'll have sidewalks on both sides of the street. There's three neighborhood play park areas of approximately 8,000 square feet each. The contents of each of those will be determined as it goes through development, but it will accommodate both adults and children with items such as pocket parks and tot lots. As far as Burton's Pond is concerned, and Todd will go into more detail on this, but it will be made accessible to canoes, kayaks, and fishing. There'll be some benches right around the clubhouse. There's also at the clubhouse, we have two tennis courts and a community clubhouse. Community clubhouses for both sides of the project, both sides of 24, multifamily and single. And then there's a swimming pool, and there's the 2 acres of open park that Mike talked about, which was the archaeologic area. And all through that side also, there'll be street lights, and there's also a bus stop that's right along Holly Mount Road. Which Brent can point point out. There's a bus stop. If you look on your handout, you'll see it's on there. We have bus stops on each side of the road, each side 24. As Jim had mentioned, Mrs. Holland commended us on the on our efforts to make a and create a project design that respects the natural environment and truly achieves the intent of the cluster ordinance. And that's something that we're very proud of. We didn't do it all by ourselves. Actually, the state did give us some really good suggestions in regard to that too, and we appreciate that. But all these items went into making that cluster a superior design over what we've traditionally seen. As far as stormwater management is concerned, this is near and dear to me. I feel we have the opportunity here, and as Jim had mentioned earlier, to show you that why we should be allowed to do what we do on this, and as far as densities on both sides, even though the densities are relatively low. We're given the opportunity here with Mike's blessings to do additional stormwater management above and beyond what we normally would do. So we are implementing best management practices to meet the TMDL requirements. But it's also our intent to treat all the surface runoff that discharges to any of the receiving waters. And by this, I mean front and rear yards. And so what I've done is put a board together here that will take you through a typical train of, and it's actually an actual one that will be built. It shows exactly where it is. This is not just an empirical example. But we employ duplicated or tiered best management practices. We are not disturbing the downstream wetlands. We'll stay out of those. And these stormwater management practices will be both structural and non-structural. Structural meaning the pipe systems that are used. Also, storm drain inlets and water quality sumps that we have within those, and wet ponds. Non-structural, we have grass swales. And in addition to that, some of these are designed differently depending on where we are, as bioswales or biofiltration swales or vegetative swales. There's all kinds of different ways to do them. But we'll provide the treatment that's necessary. As far as the maintenance of these is taken care of in the open space management plan that's also in your three-ring binder. I do want to explain a little bit about this stormwater train, though, specifically on this site, so you can see how this one works, because it's going to be applied throughout the development. On this one, between the lots and the greenway, we'll have a grass infiltration area or biofiltration area, depending on, again, what the soil characteristic is, what the elevations are. From there, we travel somewhere between 100 and 200 feet, and I prefer to keep it the lesser, to small inlets along the storm drain pipe that have sumps in it to collect sediment that is not collected by these filters, that some of it does bypass, so we collect it there, and then we'll go on to the actual basin itself. And in the basin, what we're proposing to do is provide basins that are structurally sound, basins that are wet ponds. Wet ponds gives us the best treatment in those locations, so we will do that. And the treatment effectiveness as far as for this area of the inland bays is a 40% reduction in nitrogen and phosphorus. That's the target. We have been through multiple gyrations with the state because they are developing their model. And in each case, every time we went through it, we came through and we were meeting the, or exceeding that 40% requirement. As it stands today with the current model, we are at 48% reduction in both nitrogen and phosphorus. Those numbers to me now seem realistic. Originally they were telling us we were removing 100%, and we didn't even believe that as engineers, but We worked with them some more, and 48% does seem reasonable. As far as the open space management plan I talked about, will be provided for the Homeowners Association, and it'll talk about application of fertilizers, grass cutting, forested areas, non-tidal wetland buffer maintenance, landscape maintenance, native grass areas maintenance, recreational area maintenance, stormwater management facilities maintenance, dealing with geese, dealing with algal blooms, pond safety. It'll talk about mosquito control. It'll talk about budgeting for maintenance, and it'll even provide them checklists because we know homeowners associations have a tough time doing what they do because they're usually volunteers. And then Todd will talk a little bit more about the large pond maintenance that's necessary. And then one other quote I wanted to present to you was also from Denrick. This was their first review through the PLUS process. It said, RDM through McCrone Inc. conceptually designed Burton Pond Communities as an environmentally sensitive subdivision that will meet the total maximum daily load nutrient reduction for nitrogen and phosphorus in the inland bays. So we're sure we're being good stewards of the environment and taking care of it. Sediment erosion control. As far as that's concerned, too, Mike gave us a liberty to go a little bit above and beyond what's normally required. And we've done that here. And I want to present, this is the same flow path or train that was for stormwater management, which was permanent. Sediment control is just during construction. And again, once grading commences, these measures have to be employed. Now, what we've done here that's different from standard sediment erosion control is Mike through RDM has agreed to provide a super silt fence that's going to run all the way along the woodland on the south boundary of the property. Now, that is going to be a super silt fence that is in addition to what's required by sediment control folks. It'll provide a couple of things. One, will provide a permanent barrier so that people will not, or contractors will not work in the woods. So it'll preserve the woods, the woodlands, and the wetlands. Secondarily, should our upstream systems from that, should the contractors' construction practices, I should say, fail, it'll provide another barrier to catch sediment and prevent it from damaging anything downstream. Now, the standard sediment silt fence will be placed 20 feet forward or upland of the super silt fence that we're talking about. So you've got a dual layer there. If it is more advantageous for us to provide a temporary earthen dike or diversion swale to catch the stormwater and take it to a pond or a dike, then we'll do that instead of that silt fence because it'll be more effective. The next thing they'll be implemented that's a little different is the sediment basins or traps themselves. Sediment basins and traps have to be maintained, and a lot of times they short circuit and don't do their job. So in this case, we're proposing to enlarge them larger than normal so that the sediment detention time will increase. It'll allow sediments to settle out. In addition to that, we'll provide baffles, which will provide a flow train, again, for the stormwater and increase the detention time. So, again, sediments and pollutants will fall out. There's nothing new about what we're doing. It really is taken right from the wastewater treatment business. It's done the same way in lagoons. So that's where it comes from. And then as far as outlet structures are concerned, these outlets, we have, and this is a standard practice, but not a lot of folks use it, are these skimmer dewatering devices. When installed properly, they do work well, and that'll also make sure that the sediment stays in there and only pulls the water off the top or slightly below. So all these methods, and I guess I left one out, we're going to duplicate another place, and that's going to be on the storm drain inlets. When the curbing starts to go in and all of a sudden the silt fence that is normal that goes around these inlets starts to disappear because you're starting to grade, we're going to provide these bag filters which go in the inlets, and or bag filters that the grates fit inside so that sediments will be filtered again before they get to the ponds. And hopefully we can, if we can keep the sediments out of the ponds, then the ponds are going to do an even better job.